whatever kind of physical social distancing people may have to do, solidarity is the only thing that's going to get people through this. And that's something that is deeply needed in the U.S., and it's something that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party alike, I think, have spent decades trying to destroy when it means anything other than corporate solidarity, the solidarity between billionaires. But when it means working people standing together and poor people standing together in order to ensure that they have a future, our government has always struggle to fight that. And that's precisely what we need. I think this virus is revealing all of the weakest links in American society, you know, from everything from the lack of sick leave to the absolute precarity with which most people live in terms of housing costs and medical costs. And for those reasons alone, I think this virus may hit the U.S. much harder than it does nations with stronger social safety nets. And I think this is a moment to push extremely hard for workers' rights and for all of those issues that I think, you know, that I think have come to the front in the last year or two, regardless, in American politics. And this is not a moment to back away from them.
And it's just kind of tragic that there are so many, tragic but also heartening that there are so many communities here in the U.S. who, in the absence of government support, are organizing themselves collectively as much as possible. Incredible stories of, you know, people helping one another in their community in organized ways, ensuring supplies get to them. But this is something the government should be taking care of, you know, with our tax dollars. People are stepping into the vacuum, but it shouldn't have to be that way. Ben, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you. We'll post a link to your Nation magazine article from our website so people can read it themselves.
Thanks, Sonali. It's been great talking to you.
My guest is Ben Ehrenreich, a journalist and writer. His most recent book, The Way to the Spring, is based on his reporting from the West Bank. His next book, Desert Notebooks, A Roadmap for the End of Time, will be published in July by Counterpoint Press. And we've been discussing his latest article for The Nation called We're Struggling with the Coronavirus in Spain, but we are vastly more prepared than the U.S. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kits Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, listener supported community radio.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one, news, views, and hip-hop.
This is Sister Soulja on Hard Knock Radio. Listen closely.
¿Qué pasa, raza? This is Deuce Eclipse, the Oi Joaquin, your parte chino. Check it out. Listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Hey, this is Patrice Rushen. And whenever I'm in the Bay Area and I need good information and great radio, it's all about Hard Knock Radio.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. We are still doing our coverage of the coronavirus, and we've been checking in with folks all around the world, Italy, down south, and now we want to find out what's happening right here on our home front in San Francisco, which has been a major focal point for activities around the coronavirus in terms of policies that are being put in motion, the type of reaction or lack of action people have been taking, and then of course all the underlying issues, whether or not there will be a rent freeze, what's happening with commercial properties, you know, what's going to happen with people who work in the gig economy. Somebody who has his finger on the pulse and covers San Francisco very well with his publication 48 Hills is Tim Redman. So Tim, man, I've been chomping at the bit to talk to you because I would imagine there's so much to cover with San Francisco being in the national and international spotlight.
Oh, there absolutely is. I mean, the city was at the front of the curve in terms of telling everybody to stay at home. And now we're seeing efforts to halt all non-payment of rent and Ellis Act evictions, basically stop any evictions. There's talk about moving homeless people into hotel rooms that the city will rent. I mean, there's a lot of activity going on right now in San Francisco, some of which could actually spill over, you know, after this virus, eventually, after we get past the curve, you know, some of this could spill over into kind of larger policy questions.
Let's talk about the couple of things that made headlines. First, it was a call to action for people to stay sheltered in before it was nationally given and before the state even talked about it. But also at the same time, San Francisco has a high rate of people who have been contracted with the virus. And a lot of it people are attributing to the fact that people were hanging out and not taking it as seriously. How do we kind of, you know, peel back that onion, and what's the ins and outs of that?
Well, there's no question that, particularly in the early days, and even now, even today, some people are not taking seriously the social isolation concept. I mean, I was out at Ocean Beach, and I admit, yes, I went out, but I have a dog, and I'm allowed to take my dog out, and I took my dog to Ocean Beach thinking, okay, it'd be pretty quiet. There's a big space. That's a big, wide open space. Stay away from people. And it was jammed with people. And this is what we're seeing. It's like people are cooped up in their house all day, and then they want to get out. And if it's a nice day, they get out. But there's, you know, it's really tough if you're in a big crowd to isolate yourself and stay 6 feet away from people. So, you know, and I'm as guilty as anyone else of wanting to go out for a walk or take the dog out. But I think a lot of people didn't take seriously how important it is to stay away from other folks. So you've got that going on. And at the same time, you do have the city, you know, particularly the Department of Public Health has advised the mayor, who has taken their advice, that really the safest thing to do is to keep people at home. This is, of course, an easy thing to say to those of us who have shelter and have a place to live with, you know, enough room and are able to stay at home. And some of us are able to work from home. It's a whole different thing when you have more than 8,000 people homeless on the street. And that's a major worry now in San Francisco, as it is in other communities. You have 8,000 people homeless on the street, and then you have 19,000 people living in single-room occupancy hotels in very tight quarters, often with shared bathrooms, where it's very, very hard to self-isolate. So these are challenges that the city's trying to take on.
Let's look a little bit at the gig economy, which I said was something that is of concern. We know that there was an attempt to pass a stimulus package, and fortunately that was blocked, you know, because a lot of that stimulus was going to bail out big companies, and very little, except maybe a one-time $1,000 check or $600 check if you made less than $75,000, was going to go to you. And that, I guess, in the minds of whoever crafted that bill, was supposed to be satisfactory. But even with that being of subpar caliber, you still had people in the gig economy who just weren't going to get anything. And for people who don't know what the gig economy is, it basically means when you work, you get paid, and if you don't work, you don't get paid. And a lot of people are quote-unquote independent contractors, and many folks have lost their gigs, especially if you're in the arts, you're DJing, you're certain types of teachers, et cetera, et cetera. San Francisco is made up of a lot of people where the gig economy kind of emerges from. Uber and Lyft are two primary examples of that gig economy. How's that shaping up for them? What's the conversations that you hear over in the city around the plight of those workers?
Well, it's a huge issue. And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned the stimulus bill. You know, Davey, isn't it kind of crazy that if you make over $75,000 a year, you get a bigger check because you're less likely to need it? It should be the opposite. It should be the people who make less than $75,000 who get a bigger check because they're less likely to have any savings or be able to get it through. At any rate, yes, this has had a tremendous impact, particularly on the arts community, where, as you well know, people who are DJs, people who are performers, get paid when they're working and not when they're not. And there are basically no more live events in San Francisco, which is an appropriate response to the pandemic, but very, very difficult on people who make their living, working at live events. So, plus you have obviously the Uber and Lyft drivers, the taxi drivers, who are facing the fact that people aren't going anywhere. So, the one of the big issues here is if you're in the gig economy, you don't get unemployment.
Right? Yes.
If you have a regular, a traditional job, and you get laid off because your restaurant closed, you can apply for unemployment. You don't get any of those benefits if you're a gig worker. In fact, if you're if you work at a company in San Francisco that provides you with health insurance, you get laid off, you still have your health insurance for a while, for probably 6 months at least, right? That's not the case for the gig economy workers. If you're a gig economy worker, either you have no health insurance or you're paying for it yourself through Obamacare, through Covered California, and it's expensive. It's hundreds, maybe $1,000 a month, depending on your age and a few other factors. You don't have any money, you can't pay your health insurance, which is a terrible situation to be in right now when we're facing this horrible public health crisis. So the city's talking about this, and Supervisor Hillary Ronan, in fact, is pushing for the city to borrow $20 million to get a $20 million line of credit, which, because we're San Francisco, we could easily do, and make that money available in no-interest short-term loans to both small businesses that have had to close because no one's going shopping or no one's going to restaurants, and to individuals who are hurt by this, just so we can get through this period. And this is something that on the national level we're really going to have to talk about. There are millions and millions of people whose livelihood, whose ability to pay their rent, pay their mortgage, depends on being able to go out and work in the gig economy. And when that shuts down, as it's shut down, a lot of people are going to be hurting.
What's interesting is that the cannabis clubs are still open and they're servicing people. They're considered essential businesses. And, I have no disdain or would even hate on people that are in that profession. But if you think about it, it was just a short time ago that part of, selling was the gig economy in the underground sense. And now you have it kind of legitimized and people doing that and making money. But at the same time, it bumped off all those people who once upon a time were doing it illegally, which meant that they were stigmatized. And that meant that they couldn't get a regular job and they would have to be in the gig economy. That might be the guy who repairs your car on the side, or the person who may cut your hair, on the side, all those types of things. We were talking about it in terms of entertainment, but I'm just looking at all the little side hustles that people have that is part of the gig economy, which sometimes it's on the books and sometimes it isn't. And so how will those people even be able to apply for a loan, or is that just open for anybody?
Oh, I think the idea is to make it as broadly available as possible. I mean, you mentioned people who cut your hair. There's an awful lot of people who are in that business who are in the gig economy, who don't have a steady job someplace. They just go around and nobody's getting their hair cut right now. One person I know who's a hair cutter, she basically said, she put something up on Facebook and said, buy a future haircut now, like pay me for it now, and in 3 months when I'm able to again, I'll cut your buy a gift certificate, because that's the only way she can think of actually being able to survive. So no, it's very important that any relief package that the city passes, that the state passes, that the federal government passes, applies to people who are in the gig economy, and certainly applies to people who may, for example, have a criminal record of some sort and now are only getting by doing side gigs. That shouldn't disqualify anyone from a benefits package, because that's absolutely essential. I mean, it's absolutely essential that this be as broad as possible to help people out. It's funny, just a year ago, Davey, if we were talking a year ago about the idea of just sending people money, of a basic annual income, that was not even on the political agenda. No one was even talking about it. And now, at least, there's people even in Congress saying we should just send people money. Of course, again, the challenge is right now the stimulus bill says we're going to send that money to taxpayers. And that's great, but there's a lot of people who work in the kind of shadowy underground / gig economy who may not file their taxes, may not make enough money to pay taxes, may not be able to file taxes. There are a lot of people who are undocumented and are therefore not traditionally taxpayers. I mean, they pay their taxes, money gets taken out of their check, but they may not file because they are undocumented. All of those people need the money even more than a lot of, quote, taxpayers. So any kind of relief bill has got to keep in mind, this is a very different world than it was 20 years ago in terms of how people work.
That's the voice of Tim Redman out of San Francisco, 48 Hills, if you're just tuning in. Let me ask you this, Tim. I was on a conference call yesterday with the mayor of Oakland. She had business people, small business people, on a conference call, and there was a lot of talk about what can be done and what couldn't be done, et cetera, et cetera. One of the suggestions that came up was that Oakland should, as an incentive, give tax breaks to medium-sized businesses that employ smaller businesses so that, you know, folks can maybe get paid or you know, can trickle down. And our mayor over here in Oakland, Libby Schaff, said they didn't give tax breaks to any of the companies, and she had mentioned that that was something that was part and parcel to San Francisco, which leads me to this question. We know that companies like Twitter and others were lured into San Francisco with the promise of having these enormous tax breaks, where they essentially, you know, worth billions and paid nothing. What sort of load are they being asked to carry at this point because they were able to save so much money? How are they contributing at this time of crisis? And are they being tapped to say, look, y'all didn't pay taxes, but you know what? You can help these gig workers and make sure that they're whole. That's one question. And the second thing is, which I don't think a lot of people know, many of the people in the tech industry are now gig workers. You know, gone are the days where everybody just made, you know, these six-figure salaries, and some may do it in the gig economy, but many times people are there for, you know, 1 or 2 years, and they move on to the next company. So you don't have that seniority and that consistency that we have, you know, that we thought that everybody working in that industry would have. So how is that shaping out with the tech companies?
Well, one of the things that frustrates me, I would say the thing that frustrates and actually infuriates me the most about the entire government response to COVID-19 at every level is that at every level we're hearing, I hear the governor on, you know, making a speech and saying, you know, we're all going to have to work together. It's going to be inconvenient. It's going to be difficult. There's going to be suffering, but we all have to work together. But that's not true, because no one is asking the 1% to contribute. No one is saying to Twitter, we gave you a $25 million tax break, now we need some of that back. Because in fact, some of these tech companies are doing just fine, even through this, because their line of work isn't affected in the same way. But the fact is, you know, I looked 2 days ago at the stock exchange numbers, and Jeff Bezos is still worth $111 billion. Bill Gates is still worth $98 billion. There are some very, very rich people in San Francisco and in this country who are not being asked to contribute their fair share. This has to do with big companies, and it has to do with rich individuals. And I mean, that's just a really frustrating thing. Why should somebody who's making $30,000, $40,000 a year in a restaurant get $600 when there's a handful of billionaires still hoarding all of this vast amount of wealth that could actually radically change the economy? You know, the president talks about how, you know, this is the equivalent of fighting a war. Well, you know what? When we fought World War II, rich people were taxed at 80% of their income to pay for it. And if we're going to look at this kind of situation where the economy is going to be in serious trouble, we seriously have to ask the very wealthy and these big rich corporations that we've given tax breaks to, that we've given so many benefits to, instead of trying to bail out these big industries, let's ask them to help a little bit. That's what's really frustrating to me, is that no one at any level of government is talking about that.
Let me put on my cynicism hat for a minute. And one would look and say that what we're seeing, this response or lack of response, is not by accident. It's not because of ineptitude. It's very deliberate. And at the end game is to really have a massive transferring of wealth that will never, ever come back to poor people and the middle class. Are we looking at something that is moving in that direction? That's what I fear is happening, that the economy is going to be really upended at the end of the day, and that, you know, the folks that are heading these big tech companies, that 1% that you mentioned, they're going to be all right, but you're going to have millions and millions of people who are not only beholden to them, but are going to have to absolutely depend upon them in a way that you may see us having to grovel and just be happy that we got crumbs. Like, you know what? I don't need $15 an hour. Just give me $5 an hour and I'll just be happy. You know what? I don't really need an apartment for me and my family of four. We'll just sleep in a room. We're going to have people that are going to be that desperate that's going to be the reality that they're going to have to deal with. And that's what I'm afraid we're headed towards. Am I wrong in thinking that way? Are we on that path, or do we have sharper minds in the middle of this conversation that is trying to prevent us from moving in that direction?
Well, honestly, we've been moving in that direction for quite a few years now, with the high concentration of wealth and the desperation on the lower end. And you know, when you have a crisis like this, it can go two ways. It can go that way, or it can go the way where people basically rise up and say, "We're not going to tolerate that. We're not going to. This is not acceptable." For example, we have a moratorium on evictions in San Francisco, but that's going to have to be something that's going to have to spread around. People can't pay their rent because they can't work. You can't throw them out on the streets. And you know, for homeowners, there are working people who own homes who, you know, you can't tell them you can't go to work and you can't make a paycheck, but yet you have to pay your mortgage to the bank. The banks are going to have to suck some of this up at a certain point. We're going to have to say to the banks, you know, look, you folks are going to have to wait. It's not a question of the people who are struggling to pay the rent or make their mortgage who are going to have to wait and struggle and grovel. Some of this is going to have to come from the top. There's a lot of money in this economy. There's still a lot of tremendous wealth, and I think that we're going to have to just keep pushing at every level to say, no, that's not okay. We're not going to let this crisis turn this economy into one of even more great wealth and great poverty. And I really think that's a message we need to keep putting out to people.
What's the situation with those who are undocumented? We saw in places like New York that ICE was taking advantage of this shelter in and going to houses and trying to arrest people. Is that the case in San Francisco? We know that this president promised to send a SWAT team, a special cadre of officers into quote-unquote sanctuary cities and start literally just pulling people out and deporting them. What's the scenario right now in the midst of all this?
Well, San Francisco has made a very strong policy, you know, as does Berkeley and Oakland, that we do not cooperate with ICE and we do not cooperate with that type of activity. And we're not seeing ICE SWAT teams going house to house and trying to arrest people at this point. Not saying that it's not going to happen, but we haven't seen that happening. However, of course, with this administration and with those kinds of threats, the fear that we all have is that undocumented people are not going to seek out medical care when they get sick. And again, in a public health emergency, the last thing you want is people not getting necessary medical care because they don't have insurance, because they're undocumented and afraid, because they can't afford it. I mean, it's just really important that people who are sick get properly treated. Otherwise, the virus just continues and things get astronomically worse. So that's one of the concerns. And again, it's really important, I think, to put out that San Francisco, if you're undocumented in San Francisco and you go to the hospital for treatment because you're sick or your kid is sick, the public health authorities do not work with ICE and will not work with ICE, and it's really important that everybody understands that.
How has the mayor been doing? Now, for a very long time, you've had some pretty sharp critiques of her. She's been enjoying the national spotlight, you know, so I guess maybe from one standpoint, us being in the Bay Area, we just kind of keep the critiques to ourselves and don't join the fray that, you know, that people like the president and the far right would put out there. But at the same time, some of her policies, quite a few of her policies have led to this income inequality. So how do we look at what she's doing, and are there deals being cut that we need to keep our eyes and ears open? For example, what's happening with Airbnb? What's happening with the developers? What's happening with that tech guru? I always forget his last name, Ron. You know,
Conway.
I'm talking Conway, you know, what's happening with those folks? Because I just don't see them sitting on their fingers going, oh, let's just wait until this is over. I think I see them trying to position themselves to make sure that policies are going to be favorable for them, or that they can push back on policies that we would be advocating for to continue if it helps people now than helping people later down the road.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a big challenge because, you know, members of the Board of Supervisors, the more progressives on the Board of Supervisors, have been pushing really hard for policies like a ban on evictions. And, you know, they're going to push for the idea of a rent moratorium. And, you know, and that's not going to help the landlord class. And I'm not saying all landlords are big and rich. There are small landlords who need the rent to pay the mortgage. And in that case, you've got to look at a mortgage moratorium with the banks. You know, I think she's in a tough position. And to her credit, and I will say this absolutely, I've been a critic of Mayor Breed's policies, but to her credit, she has been listening to the public health folks. And she has been following the advice of the doctors in the Department of Public Health who are treating this as a medical emergency. You know, on the other hand, there are some real disagreements here. The mayor's office, the Human Services Agency, has pushed back against the idea of renting, you know, 5,000 hotel rooms. And you know what? There's 15,000 empty hotel rooms in San Francisco right now. Tourists aren't coming here. So there's all these empty hotel rooms. Why don't we take those over, you know, pay for them at a lower rate, but rent those hotel rooms and move homeless people into those hotel rooms right now so they're not on the streets where they're in tight quarters and likely to spread the virus. Now, when this came up a week and a half ago, the mayor's administration at Human Services Administration said, no, we don't want to do that. That's not the approach that we're taking right now. We want to get homeless people into shelters. And, of course, the problem with shelters is it's a very congested area, and you're putting a whole lot of people in a small space. So there are policy disagreements there that we've seen that are coming forward, and I think we're going to continue to see the question of just how far we can push this idea of making sure that the banks and the big landlords and the big corporations are going to pay their fair share, and also are going to pay their fair share as we recover from this. Because at some point, you know, the curve is going to pass, and at some point this virus is going to, you know, burn itself out, or we're going to find a vaccine. And we'll find some drugs that are going to treat it. And at some point, we will emerge from this public health crisis. And as we do, we're going to emerge in San Francisco and in other places with a deeply wounded economy. And we're going to have to scramble for recovery. And how is that going to work? And who's going to be pulling the strings behind those recovery measures? That's what I think we should be thinking about now.
What would you ask people to do at this moment in time while we're sitting at home, working from home? What would you ask San Franciscans and people who work there and people who care about the city? What would you ask them to start doing?
Well, number one, and I'm only saying what the public health authorities say, work from home, stay at home, you know, try not to congregate in large groups. The social distancing, the 6-foot thing is real. Like, you know, if you decide you're going to take a walk in the park and there's 10,000 people already there, go find someplace else to take a walk. I mean, don't, you know, let's not spread this any further. But on a political level, now is the time to start organizing ourselves and talking about what kind of measures not only can slow the spread of the virus, but can help us in a more equitable economic system as we recover. Now is the time to start thinking about that. What are those policies? How are we going to do that?
And start crafting them and start pushing them. Are there any... Are there any levers that you feel need to be pushed that are amenable right now to those suggestions and can maybe get some momentum if we start pushing now?
Well, I think one of the things that we really need to be looking at is what policies, what taxes can we implement on a state and national level? I mean, and what can we do on a local level that will equalize some of this economic inequality as we recover from this? I mean, you know, we're going to need a major national recovery effort, and that's only going to work if Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos have to contribute more than the gig workers who've been out of work for 6 months. You've been out of work for 3-4 months. They say, okay, you're not going to get evicted. You can be behind on your rent, but at some point, it's 4 months from now, and now you're 4 months behind in your rent, and it's 6 months from now, and now you're 6 months behind in your rent. And slowly your gig work comes back, but you still got that 6 months of back rent to pay. How is that going to happen? And to what extent are we going to say to the very wealthy and the big landlords, well, you know what? You're going to have to eat that. The gig economy worker, the restaurant worker, the person who's scrambling just isn't going to be able to pay all that back rent, and something's going to have to happen on that. So these are the kind of things we're going to have to talk about.
One of the things, Tim, that we've seen is that San Francisco has a lot of unoccupied homes. This is before this happened, and now we're seeing it even in more stark of a view. It looks like now we should be pushing for particular policies, one, to find out how people can get into these abandoned homes. So maybe now we should be thinking about not allowing unoccupied properties just to sit in the city and county of San Francisco for these long periods of time. That should be one thing. The second thing is we're seeing how there's no traffic, and maybe people need to permanently not have to come into these offices, and there should be hubs and other ways in which they can work so we don't have the massive amount of congestion that we were having. I just remember about 4 or 5 years ago, as these tech companies moved into San Francisco, where they allowed people to work from home, then all of a sudden they wanted everybody congregating into the city by 8 o'clock sharp, and we just seen traffic jams that became the worst in the country and even, you know, top 10 in the world. Maybe we need to return to those policies where there's a little bit more autonomy and a little less, you know, having people centralized in one place. That seems to be a benefit, so at least we can enjoy some of this open space.
Yeah, there's you got two questions there, and I'll address the second one first. I think that as this crisis peters out, and as the you know, this particular public health crisis comes to an end, we're going to see a lot more people still working from home. I think that people are picking up on and figuring out the technology that exists. People are figuring out how to use online meetings, how to do online discussions, and in fact, you know, how to do online teaching. And I think we're going to see that a lot of that's going to continue. People are going to figure out that, hey, this makes a lot more sense in many cases than everyone having to get on buses and in cars and drive down the peninsula to these tech hubs or to San Francisco to these tech hubs. I think there's no question some of that is going to happen. Right? But to your first point, there are many thousands of vacant housing units in San Francisco, in Oakland. I don't know as many in Berkeley, but there are definitely a lot in San Francisco and in Oakland. And I think one of the things you know, Supervisor Dean Preston at one of the recent board meetings said, you know, look, I'm asking all the landlords who have a vacant unit to step up and say, hey, there's people who need to live there. There's homeless people who need to live there. There's ways that we can do this and we can work with you as a city. But he also said, if the landlords don't step up, we're going to have to take them. We're going to have to come up with some policy by eminent domain or whatever else we can to say it is in a housing and public health crisis, it is not acceptable to be holding usable residential property off the market. So that's a big step, but it's something that cities are going to have to look at as we, you know, as we get through this.
Real talk and something to think about. You know, as we close out, Tim, I just remind people, those who have power and resources are definitely thinking about how to craft the society after it's all over so that it further benefits and furthers enriches them. And we should be taking this time out to think about how this society should be crafted so that it can level out the playing field and be more equitable for us. So thank you very much, Tim. And I'm glad to see that 48 Hills is still on the pulse. Tell people how they can get a hold of it.
Simply just go to 48hills.org. We are working through this. We are following this crisis. We are posting stories every day about what's going on in San Francisco. And, you know, if you want to get in touch with me, you've got tips or ideas or anything, tim@48hills.org works perfectly well. So, yeah, we're watching this very, very closely.
We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
And my last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
David D. Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. Big shout out to Tim Redman, who we were just talking to, and now we want to kind of turn our attention from the city of San Francisco, city and county of San Francisco, to the beloved city of Oakland. And joining us on the phone line, no stranger to our airwaves, is Tanya Love. She is a legislative aide, among other things, an activist, and a sister who keeps her finger on the pulse and keeps many of us informed. So, Tanya, I know you were talking off air. You were saying that this has been overwhelming. You haven't really had a chance to just reflect and take in the magnitude of what we're dealing with because, you know, you and folks like yourselves are in the middle of a firestorm in terms of the amount of people you're hearing from and the demands that they're putting on. So what is that like in itself?
Well, I was just thinking about, you know, how this whole, you know, event, this pandemic is really kind of historical and something that will probably be in the history books on how, you know, America has responded, how, you know, our government has responded, state versus the federal, worldwide, all of that. And I haven't really had time to kind of reflect on that because of being in the middle of it all and having to help people navigate the situation, and not only other people that I work with, but just myself. Like just knowing how, you know, all the changes that have been put in place is affecting me. I mean, I even have a funny story about it. So I haven't really had time to really think about how, you know, this is affecting me personally when trying to navigate it on a professional and just a civic engagement level.
What are the main concerns that people you've been talking to been voicing, you know, when you when you're having to navigate a system, you know, what are the big key issues that really need to be ironed out once and for all?
Well, there's the public health aspect, right? So we're putting in California and in a lot of other states, you know, the public health departments are putting in what's called shelter in place order to make sure that we're all kind of doing what we can to protect ourselves and our community and prevent the spread of the virus. So that aspect of it is huge because there's a lot of people who aren't necessarily taking this public health order seriously. They're, you know, since maybe they're not watching the news, maybe they're not on social media, maybe they don't get newsletters from the public health department or the governor or the mayor or anything like that. You know, maybe they just go about their daily lives. And so they don't know whether, you know, how to actually navigate this public health order or what it means. So sometimes people think, oh, okay, so, you know, we're doing a shelter in place. That means I don't have to work. I can go to the park, or I can go to the beach, or I can take a jog in my favorite park, you know, that kind of thing. And thinking this is not necessarily something that's super dangerous and something that they should be super careful about. And so that's one piece that still needs to be worked out. The second piece is how the shelter in place is actually affecting people economically and how serious it is it's going to affect people. So there's the aspect of, you know, there are businesses and there are companies that it's decided to close down. So then how are the people that work there getting paid? And since they're not getting any income, how are they going to pay their rent? How are they going to pay their utilities? How are they going to buy food for their families? So that aspect of it is also still needing to be worked out. And so it seems to be decisions are made first, and then the consequences of those decisions are thought about after. And it's understandable in the sense that, you know, this is not necessarily new. I mean, we've had pandemics before with the flu, I think in the earliest 19th century, a major big flu, and some other big, you know, pandemics. But in the sense that this is kind of modern in that decisions need to be made quickly and for the best of the public health, and then thinking about, okay, so how is this actual decision going to affect the rest of our lives? Not even now, but after the pandemic passes, there's going to be repercussions to this pandemic that are going to be felt for a while. So those are things that, you know, are top of mind right now, is how to get people to follow the shelter in place order, and then second, how do we deal with the consequences of the shelter in place order?
Let me ask you this. You had mentioned that one of the challenges that you all see in stateside is that there are a large number of the people who haven't taken this seriously, and for many reasons, and, you know, you named off some of them, but of course it's also just a distrust, you know, like the government is telling me this, but the government has lied, you know, and we can look at all kind of examples where in the minds of many, they feel like they've been misled. But let's put that aside for a second. If we have average folks who are not taking this seriously, is a challenge maybe that also businesses themselves might not be taking this seriously, which would contribute to the consequences, meaning that if we're asking people to make a sacrifice and stay home, and it's a challenge to get them to buy in, will it be a challenge to get businesses to buy in and say, look, we know your employees aren't working, but we need to get them paid, or maybe you need to take a loss as well? And so what sort of conversations do you anticipate, or, you know, have you been privy to or even heard about, that really comes with the businesses themselves? Are the owners and presidents and CEOs, are they taking this as seriously as needed?
I think there was a point in time when the decision was first happening where you would get a lot of businesses saying, so let's, for example, the Alameda County shelter in place order happened on a Monday, and then it said it goes into effect tomorrow. And so folks are like going about their lives, you know, figuring out, you know, what's going to happen at work tomorrow, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden they're being told that they need to close tomorrow. Now, is there any prep for closing tomorrow? I mean, did the businesses, were businesses able to, you know, reach out to their employees and say that we're closed? Were they able to reach out to their customers to say that they're closed? They still got bills to pay. They still had all these needs to take into account. I mean, closing a business is not as easy as just shutting one's doors. There's lots of things to take into consideration. So some of these businesses may have been like, I can't close tomorrow. Or they're thinking about, you know, they have a huge contract and they need that contract to work in order to pay, you know, their employees, or all of this stuff to think about. And so to be able to be told that they have to just all of a sudden close tomorrow was probably a huge leap for them to wrap their heads around. And so for businesses to, you know, to be slow on the concept of shelter in place is not surprising to me. But at the same time, I do think there is a level of, okay, so, you know, my beauty salon is still open so that I can still go and get my hair done. You know, that kind of thing. That could probably come into play. Whereas if all of a sudden nothing was open and there was nothing for people to do, then that would present, not necessarily a challenge, but basically a fait accompli where, you know, I was planning to get my hair done, but obviously my store isn't open, so I can't get my hair done, so I must stay inside. You know, that kind of thing?
Right.
So I think it is an interplay of that. But I think there needs to be kind of a level of understanding and just looking at the issue from different points of view. I was watching the news the other day, and there was a segment on how there are gun stores that are still open. And that, I think in one particular in Alameda County in Fremont, they, you know, they protested and they were like, no, I'm going to stay open, and actually took a court order to have them be closed. And there are different things to consider when it came to that decision, because there was a high demand for guns after the shelter in place order came into place, because people were concerned about the safety of their business. So a lot of people went in and said, I'm going to buy a gun. There's also, you know, some people had, you know, Second Amendment issues, or like, you're, you know, infringing on my right to own a gun, or, you know, all these other things. And so, you know, that business, you know, was stubborn and staying open regardless of the fact that they weren't practicing social distancing and they weren't doing what was best for the health of the community. They were thinking about their customers and their rights. And so there's lots of different considerations that come into play, and whether or not a business or an individual actually follows shelter-in-place rules.
Let me ask you this. I talked to a business owner recently, and they were reluctant to close. And they said, you know, let me tell you something. It's easy to tell somebody to close when it's them not losing a paycheck. He said, when some of these politicians who are ordering us to close give up their paychecks, and they're sitting there wondering how they're going to put food on the table in a week or so, or how they're going to pay their mortgage or rent next month, then it might be a whole different story. It might, one, make people become very efficient and very effective in finding a solution, because everybody's suffering, so to speak. You know, you are literally in the shoes of the people that you're asking to make this sacrifice. You're making it too. Or, you know, they will see the inadequacies of the system and work to fix them. You know, they'd be like, wow, I never thought what it's like when somebody's off for a month and they have a $3,000 rent bill that's due. And, you know, like I was on a call the other day and they were saying, hey, I'm willing to forego the rent. This was a landlord speaking, but he was saying, could we get a break on the property tax? You know, those sorts of things coming up. So, you know, have there been any sort of conversation where people been like, you know, maybe we need to give up our paychecks and make that sacrifice? Because really, that's the ultimate sacrifice. It's not so much staying home. It's staying home and not having an income for a lot of people.
I have not heard any conversation of anyone willingly sacrificing their own tech. But I just want to put a little bit of perspective in. So if a government, like if people who work for government do not get their paycheck, their ability to serve the community is affected. If we got rid of certain taxes, so let's say property tax or sales tax or whatever, that limits the amount of income that the state has in order to provide services. So if the state doesn't have money, then they can't give money to provide homeless shelters or whatever emergency services that are required for COVID-19. So in some instances, you can't waive a lot of things, because that's the kind of money that we get in order to provide the services that serve the community. So there definitely does need to be some consideration on how we provide support to those who aren't taking in any income. And I think that's something that, you know, our state elected officials and our local elected officials are thinking about. But an outright forgiveness of all taxes would mean that there's no income given to local jurisdictions or to the government in order to provide the services that we all need right now. So that's something to think about.
It's a rhetorical thing, but it's definitely presents the challenge that everybody's faced with. It ultimately boils down to, who is in a position to hold the bag or to take the L, so to speak, right? Who's in a position to be on the short end? You know, me or you, we're pawns, so to speak. We can't really be on that short end. But from the perspective of somebody who has a lot, they're like, yeah, you're just pawns, so you all are disposable. And that seems to be the fundamental dividing line. Like, you should be big enough to take it, and they're saying, yeah, and you're small enough to be expendable. So who wins at the end of the day?
Yeah, I think that's a classic conflict when it comes to living in a capitalist society, where we have a lot of people that have a big pot of the money and that are requiring a lot from people who don't have that big pot of the money. I mean, I think that's a big issue across the board, where we're looking at, you know, climate change, like countries like, you know, the United States are the biggest causes of global warming in the world, and yet, you know, we're, you know, hemming and hawing about what we're going to do about climate change. you know, or, you know, the rich, you know, companies that, you know, own lots of businesses and yet pay their employees, you know, pennies, and yet expect the employees to work 24/7 while the CEO probably clocks in maybe 3 or 4 hours a day and get, you know, gets paid a bunch of money. I think that's a classic conflict across the board, and we're going to see that, especially in cases of emergency where, again, the people who are lower income are actually required to make the sacrifice to not take an income to, even some, in some cases, I saw an article about how black and brown people are the ones that are exposing themselves the most because they have jobs that are essential, like, you know, making deliveries or working at grocery stores or doing all kinds of stuff. And so they're making the sacrifice, whereas other people aren't. And so, you know, that's, and I don't know how to solve for that issue, because that's the kind of society that we live in, that our society really functions on low-income people taking the L for us all the time. And that's, you know, it's fundamentally unfair. But I don't know how we change that.
And that's definitely something to think about. You know, I know our time is short. I know you got to get back. Is there anything that stands out from the past couple of weeks that you want our listeners to know that they should really take to heart? I know you mentioned the shelter in place, and everywhere we talk, that seems to be rule number one, you know, flatten the curve. But are there some other things that may be popping up? I know there's a push to, you know, do a rent moratorium. So I know that that will be happening today or tonight at the Oakland City Hall, if you're able to log in and participate in that. But is there anything else that we really need to think about?
Yeah, I would say the moratoriums on evictions and rent and mortgages are super, super important, because we're almost at the end of the month. We're going to be April 1st soon, and rent's always going to be due. And so how are people who are, like we had mentioned before, you know, the most vulnerable that are having to sacrifice taking in income, how are they going to pay their rent? So that's a huge topic. The state has given all local jurisdictions the ability to, well, I don't know if we call it the ability, he's given them the task of putting in place their own rules around evictions or their own rules about what to do with tenants. And so it'd be incumbent on anyone, no matter what city that they live in, to pay attention to what each city is doing and encouraging them to act quickly as possible. Another thing to pay attention to is the need for personal protective equipment for our medical providers and nurses. I would say, I mean, we all know that there is a shortage of tests, and there's a shortage of supplies. Right now, I mean, the tests and the supplies are kind of being controlled and distributed via the federal government. And we've heard that Trump say that he wants to just encourage companies to voluntarily supply, you know, equipment. So there's a push to actually get him to use, I think there's a federal law that allows him to force companies to do that work for the benefit of the public. And so if any of you are able to follow that movement and to encourage, you know, a push from our congressional representatives to really kind of push that, it would be great, because we have, again, these are people in our community that work as a nurse, that work as doctors, and they're putting their lives on the line to be able to serve our community. And the fact that we don't have enough equipment to help keep them protected is a real, you know, black mark on our society. And so please try to reach out to whoever you know that can help push our president to, you know, stop thinking voluntarily on behalf of businesses and actually force them to act. I mean, that would be great. And if you have actual resources that you know of getting equipment to protect our nurses and our doctors, if you want to volunteer to make equipment, there's definitely people talking about on social media on how to do that. So if you have the time and the ability and the skills and the money to donate, please be on the lookout for how you can do that, because that's super important.
There you go. Tanya, we appreciate Tanya Love talking to us this afternoon, giving us some food for thought. And as we said, taking this moment, this is history, and we should really see how we can ultimately push the levers so it can change and change for our mutual benefit. So thank you very much, Tanya. We're going to let you get back to work because you have been grinding.
Hey, thank you so much.
All right, we're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio, East, West, North, South, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous, speaking to the thugs. One love, we know where y'all at. Top, Brown Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415s bumping Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. And to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from these hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor guy. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, rapping to the hard side. Learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor guy. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, rapping to the hard side.
Thank you. Estás escuchando KBOO Portland. Debido a la pandemia de COVID-19, KBOO se apegará a nuestra programación regular tanto como le sea posible y dentro de algunas limitaciones a las que se enfrenta y en las que estamos trabajando.